Mary. Hi. I was going to read from some excerpts from a book that I wrote that's based on a screenplay that was very nearly made as a German-Irish co-production. I'm going to read the prologue first just to give you an idea of the concept of it. Sorry, this way I rely on actors. Okay, sorry. Red or pink? Hi, my name is Maddie. Maddie Amelia Jones. My dad is standing in front of me asking me to help him choose between two dresses. Red. It's a no-brainer. And yes, my dad. Sure. Absolutely, it hides your knees. What's wrong with my knees? Grandma says knees are the ugliest part of the human body, but Gaffer says that someone, somewhere, probably thinks knees are downright gorgeous. I'm not sure. You couldn't call Dad's knees gorgeous, not even if you were, well, desperate and very, very short-sighted. And a bit crazy. But I'm in one of my nothing bothers me moods, so I give him a hug and say, nothing, you have lovely knees. They're very easily pleased, Dad. Give them a hug and they'll believe anything. Don't get me wrong, because people often do. It's something about being nearly 13 that makes everyone get you wrong. I love my dad to bits. But sometimes, when the bits are heels as tall as, well, the tallest thing I can't think of right now, then the bits are a bit confusing. Red it is, though. Scarlett Johansson, eat your heart out, he says. Whoever she is. Or he. You can't be sure with parents. And then he whips out two pairs of shoes, pumps or heels. It's basically about a family. Jessie lives with her father, her stepmother, Eva, who sculpts erotic sculptures, fakes erotic, and her seven-year-old sister, who insists on wearing a communion veil constantly, believes she was abducted by the Virgin Mary twice, once on a motorbike. So all she wants is life to be normal. When she was in school in the US, they're just moving back to Ireland from the US, as soon as somebody found out that her father was a cross-dresser, all hell broke loose, and now she's back in Ireland, she just wants to make everything simple. She wants to keep things normal. So I've cut forward to her first day at school. Sorry. Friday, first day of the rest of our lives. No time to brood, in Eva speaks, equals making tons of friends. That's how it's meant to happen. Beyond the school gates is a wasteland of tarmac, teeming with boys. Smelly, noisy, push you out of the way just to get a snigger sort of boys, and girls with attitude. St. Bees is one of those schools that nurtures the individual, which is obviously why the uniform looks like prison issue and the girls are forced to wear skirts regardless of the weather. Right, the individual, nurtured. I take Laura's hand. She's my human shield. One more deep breath and we walk through the gate with our overweight rucksacks hanging off our shoulders like well-fed cows. Laura scans the yard to see if she can spot a real nun, but the best she can find is a Muslim girl in a hijab. Ahead of us, a group of Neanderthals have gathered around a small boy in glasses. He has to be smaller. Bullies are useless unless the victims are smaller. The leader of this intelligent posse is a red-haired genius, one of those boys who shoots up tall before he learns to join words into sentences. The victim probably has brains, because that would really annoy the tall but dim thug. And it's all about a bag. A school bag. Like, boys, seriously? We know you're not as mature as us, but why would anyone bother stealing a school bag? While I ponder this, Laura steps into the circle and stands beside the boy. As a human shield, given I'm still holding her hand, she has her drawbacks. While I'm pondering this, Laura whips her veil from her bag and puts it on. Before the gang snaps of it out of its collective wicker man, Shaun of the Dead zombie trance, I grab the bag, hand it to the bullied boy, who nods and runs off. Laura and I move on, not a single word spoken. How cool is that? First day at school and we're flicking bullies off bikes. Actually, that's probably not a good thing to do on your first day. Nora's wearing a veil. But as I'm thinking this, there's a chorus of little half-hidden cheers all around. Some kids follow us and act as if Laura's magical. Which she is, really, or would be if she wasn't my sister, and I didn't know what she did to dolls. Think trying out tortures a nun in medieval times might have had to face, and you're not even close. I decide a veil's not bad. She could be into tattoos. Or she could be a boy. Feeling all proud and big sisterly, I walk her right to the door of room 16 in the elementary school. Sorry, junior school. I even give her a hug, but only a little one, because she's in a veil and it's my first day too. Meet you by the main gate after homework club. This has been arranged by Dad so we can walk home together. Sure, she says and trots in. Which leaves me to fight my way back through the swamp of littlies. They're worse than midges, chattering their way to class. By the time I trudge up to the old convent building, the yard is empty and there's a nun by the back door looking like an Ogham stone. 5 minutes more and you'd be late, she says, tapping her watch. Which, surely, means I'm on time. Or I will be if I can find classroom 1D. I don't even have time to ponder why I'm in a class that sounds like a training bra with One Direction photos pasted all over it, because 1D is nowhere near 1B or 1A. 1D, says this boy when I pass him for the third time. I nod. Out back, third prefab on the left. He has the brownest eyes. They look kind, but maybe that's only because I want them to be, because he is seriously cute. Thanks, I manage. I don't think I ever really fancied anyone before, not even celebrities, though I said I did. Today is not the day to start, but he is gorgeous. But on Fridays, there's assembly first thing in the hall, he says, which is when I realise I'm glued to the spot like a spiky bonsai. I'd show you, but I have to get something from my locker. Yeah, right, I says, and make my feet move. That way, he says, smiling and pointing the opposite direction. Are you in 1D? Yep, it just popped out. He points to the room behind him, 2A. See, not stupid me. I checked where he lives. Just in case. Well, you never know. New school, new rules, new fanciable me. Another bell goes. I have no idea how many have been rung now, but I can't be late on my first day. So the great impression I leave with the boy is of me running down the far too highly polished corridor splat into this tall man in a suit. And no, I do not land alongside him or beside him on the ground. I land on him. Completely. Nose to nose and the taste of aftershave, hideous crushed bugs, slime and sweat in my pores and the echo chambers of my ears. And if that wasn't enough, his mug of coffee flies up into the air as we collide like the Big Bang. It completes a neatly executed triple flip dive and spills its entire contents over this woman behind him. Two in one go. It's not easy getting off a flattened teacher. There are elbows and knees and hands to manage without doing any further damage to the body underneath you. The woman who gets the acrobatic black coffee is angular, her hair like a horse's whip. The coffee covers her jumper as if rediscovering a soulmate. We all look the same in this snot-coloured uniform, so I avoid eye contact, hope my fringe is long enough to turn me into an unmemorable bison, apologise sincerely to both and vanish down the corridor into assembly. If there is any hope for me in the school, and I call on every pagan god I can think of to support me in this, then the man I floored and the woman he drenched are parents who got mislaid, not teachers. At least not my teachers. Assembly is long and monotonous. Detentions are announced, rules and regulations reiterated, as some people seem to have forgotten them. As I'm drifting off, the principal adds, oh, we have a new addition to our school this week, all the way from America. Suddenly I am aware of every stitch that went into my shoes, studying them with deep concentration. This cannot be happening. Ms. Jessica Jones? Miss Maddie Jones. I can feel him comb the crowd. Show us a hand, Maddie. Don't be shy. No way. She should be in, he confers with the teacher. 1D, can anyone find her? Of course I'm in the wrong class group, so I raise my hand very slowly, only because the alternative is a Where's Wally hunt for me. The whole room has a good gawk, and I get a clear view of the man who's just publicly embarrassed me. Pagan gods have a twisted sense of humour. See, last time we met, the principal and me, he was flat on his back. Great. Roll on the next 5 years. So that's from The Red Dress. Thanks. And then I'm just going to read a very short bit. It is short. From the book I'm going to work on while I'm on the residency, which is a very odd piece that I started writing after my mother died, where everybody lives in trees. It's called Candle Mist. The father has sparrows in his ears because he doesn't like background noise. People have three legs and tails, and it's kind of strange. The pitch for it is two little girls, one evil, one nice, and a dragon called Sweetheart. There's creatures in this world like gooseberry pigs, which are small berries shaped like snouts. They're pale pink and they emit an oink when you pick them. And they shine very brightly, but only for the length of a conversation. Just give you an idea for our problem. The reason I called the other character Jessica by mistake is I realised the two books I'm working on actually have the same first named character, which is wrong. So that's why she became Maddie. This is Jessica. Okay, sorry. Jessica Abigail Mufus DeBuff was asleep. She should have been having a dream about bunny rabbits and Pooh Bear ice cream, but the dream had come out all muddled. It was Midsummer's Eve. By order of Candlemas Council of Olders, headed by her great-grandma Dorothy DeBuff, it was a dark and stormy night full of smelly gas and nocturnal grumblings. Bells were ringing in the rooftops, Owls were hooting themselves hoarse, and fireworks had been targeted at the houses and letterboxes of the sick and infirm, as Jessica was gobbled up, feet first, by a walrus and ate her way free. So you will do it immediately. Do what? Jessica had been busy with her dream. The sherbet was pummeling the walrus into an ice cream tub with the head of a very unhappy, angry gobthork. They're like bison, but with small, angry bison, but with hands for feet. The ice cream had peed itself and turned green. Well, said her mother, what was I meant to do? Her mother lifted one of Jessica's eyelids to see if she had heard. Jessica, if you like, Jessica said, and her mother left the room at a tidy skip. Agatha filled the doorway, extending her arms and legs to touch the four corners of the frame. What did you say to Mum? I'm asleep. Go away. Nobody makes Mum skip like that in the morning, says her sister. Did you lie about something? You did. You lied about something. Jessica threw her pillow at the door, slamming it shut and forcing her sister out of the room. Agatha's nose slid under the door and sniffed around until Jessica poked a feather down the left nostril. Nose retreated with an enormous sneeze. And so Jessica was awake in the dawn of the first day of the new candle-mist year. It wasn't a calm awakening, but it was probably better than being thrown from a flying dragon by a melodious fart. She scanned the room. Her little brother Sprague was still in a spiral snooze at the end of her bed, wondering what had happened to the dream he'd been listening into. His toes were being nibbled by what looked like a small twig with hairy roots. She flicked the tree grub off Sprague's feet onto the windowsill where it was swallowed by claws, a long black cat, and rolled her brother off the bed. Go on, she said, opening the door. I need to get dressed. Woob, he said, gathering his tail around his waist, meaning worst unbrother ever. Totally woob. Didn't I mention tails? Well, in the years that will pass between our time and yours, the little bone at the base of your spine, that's right, the coccyx, yes, will shrink from a fairly decent sized but sometimes long and lumpy tail. We need them, you see, since we live in trees. Didn't I mention that either? There are two types of people in Candlemas. Simples, who live in trees, and under things. Tree grubs and gobthurks would be under things. Jessica leaned against her door. What had she been dreaming about? If she could only just remember a tiny piece, it would be worth going back to bed. She was on the point of remembering something when the tip of her tail flicked into a small puddle of slime that could only have dribbled from her sister's nose. Claws. The cat stretched both ends thoroughly and paused to cough up a very cranky tree grub and two small blue feathers before strolling over to lick the currently tasty bit of floor clean. I need a rug, thought Jessica as she scrubbed her tail in the sink while the tree grub showered under the tap. Walruses. There were definitely walruses. He snapped at her tail and she lifted him out of the sink. Do you want me to give you to Claws again? The tree grub quivered so emphatically that all his twiggles began to shake and he started hiccuping. Feeling guilty for being mean, Jessica wrapped him in a tiny blanket and put him in a box under the bed with her collection of comics where he'd be safe from the cat. Like all black cats, Claws was afraid to go under Jessica's bed in case the darkness swallowed him up. Black cats were also mostly afraid of their own shadows, spiders, and being snubbed by other cats for being unusually afraid of everything. It was going to be very difficult to make her dream into a story for Sprague. And without a story to explain the dreams he listened to, he would be impossibly smelly. He always smelt off if he hadn't had a story.
It's amazing how many genres you're able to work across. We hope to leave some time at the end for questions or comments because there is a lot of question I'm just amazed at how many genres you can manage at the same time. I'm going to go ahead and introduce Joanna. Joanna Walsh has been described as one of our most important writers. Her books are Vertigo, published in Ireland by Trent Press. We actually have a few here if anybody would like to buy one. Hotel, a meditation on hotels as a space of living that is not home. Grow a Pair, a collection of erotic fairy tales. And Fractals, her debut collection of short stories. Widely published in journals and magazines, Joanna has also runs the Twitter handle, which many of you will be familiar with, Read Women, for which she won a Women in Publishing Award in 2014. Elegant, simple, and unsettling, her work challenges genre and forms. We have two people who are doing that, I think, here. Joanna is a judge for this year's Goldsmiths Prize and is currently working on several new projects. I'll hand you over to Joanna.
Hi, I have only one thing to read. I think I'm going to read. Ooh, if I can, Yes, this is very difficult. A story I was talking with Lindsay about before, we were talking about drowning, and I have a story on the subject of drowning in this book, Vertigo, so I'll read you the whole thing, which is not too long. There is now very little in my mind. On the beach, in front of the village, which is no more than a stony strip, there are some adults, but no children, who are all on the sandy beach opposite, and a gravelled path on a slip road that leads to the hotel. I am wearing only a bikini, but I want to see the hotel. I had not considered that I would have to wear a bikini while walking from the beach to the hotel. I am too old to look good in a bikini, but even when young, I never paid enough attention to looking good in a bikini, so age is perhaps not the most important factor. I walk through the streets as though neither age nor attention paid are factors, as this is a holiday village, and it is quite normal for women who do not look good in bikinis to walk through its streets. Why should I be any exception? I also have no shoes. The tarmac is a warm body beneath my feet. The hotel is beautiful, even more beautiful up close than it was from far away. It is white, and on its facade, its name, which is the name of the village, is a dusty blue. There are three rows of windows on the front, on each shutters, the same faded blue as the sign. I could read from the beach across the estuary, within each, white lace curtains, and along each story, a blue ironwork balcony that spans all three windows. The menu of the hotel restaurant is exactly what it should be. Not cheap enough to be disappointing, not expensive enough to be intimidating. And there are ways round. Menu du jour, prefix. I cannot see the food or smell the food, but reading the menu, I know that the food will be good. There is no one on the streets. It is like lunchtime, except it isn't lunchtime. I'm not sure what time it is, or how long it took me to swim the channel. It is colder than it was on the other side of the estuary. In the harbour in front of the hotel, boats blink white, a defi, a challenge to the ocean, which is dark. It is beginning to get dark. No, it's not getting dark yet. It just feels like it might soon. From the jetty, I can see the beach on the other side of the bay, which the sun still hits, but I cannot see what you are doing. I cannot see what the children are doing. On your beach, sometimes you choose to pay attention to the children and feel worthy, and sometimes you choose to read a book and feel interested or engaged or intelligent or whatever. But whichever you are doing, I know you will be having fun because you do not worry that the children might be neglected. You never have to make the choice to neglect the children. For you to read your book is not to neglect the children, because you know that if you do not pay attention to the children, I will. I have the choice to pay attention to the children, which I may or may not find, but must give the pretense of finding fun, or else the whole concept of fun and the holiday itself tips over. Or I have the choice to read a book. But I know that if I do not play with the children, you will not play with them, not unless you really find it fun. My choice to read my book necessarily involves the worry of the possibility of neglecting the children. While you read your book, with the attention your lack of worry affords, information enters your brain, making you more interested or interesting, engaged or engaging and intelligent. And so you become less like me, who, not lacking the worry about neglecting the children, does not become any of these. I can no longer see from across the bay which of these two things you have chosen to do, and this is why I swam the estuary. The children are, in any case, now getting too old to receive the kind of attention you are not willing to give them. They are losing their last childish things. Their shoes and clothes have become bigger until they are barely distinguishable from ours. We had more children, more than one, I mean, to preserve this childishness, and also so as not to have to spend so much time together. Had we liked each other less, we'd have had 4, 5. There's nothing like love's dilution to keep things in proportion. At the end of the jetty, on my side of the estuary, a band is playing. Only the children are dancing. The adults stare at the band as though music is something they had forgotten. It must be dispiriting to perform like this afternoon after afternoon. One man nods the tune to his partner. She fails to pick it up. There are stalls selling snacks and other things, but no urgency in the queue for anything. Everyone has enough money, more than enough money for food, and no one is hungry. There are hidden patterns in everything. I should be looking at the waitresses who come from somewhere else and who are not here for a holiday, for whom being here is only a step to being elsewhere. But I am not one of the waitresses. I am one of the holiday makers. And though my compatriots in fun disgust me, I must not dismiss their feelings as unworthy by refusing to stay on side. All holidays are nightmares. You save up all year, and what do you find at the other end but someone else's house with all its own particular domestic nasties? They think you can't see where they haven't dusted. They think you can't see the cracked tiles, the mould stains on the wall behind the fridge. Not able to afford an ante-home, a hotel. We make do with a para-home. With someone else's cast-off furniture, the unfashionable crockery, the cheap fill-ins from IKEA. By they, of course, I mean I. We too have built an edifice from which no one wants anything but escape. It will fade like the hotel, and people will wonder why we ever chose to build there. It will outlast us, likely, though there have been instances of women standing in the ruins of their former homes, strangely triumphant. We could abandon ours, but we're still mortgaged to it, and by the time it's paid, we may have nowhere else to live or any means by which to move on. As an alternative, we look forward to the trapped repetition of the shore, the unfamiliar house, the road between. Again and again, we will flog fun from that exchange or something we're willing to call fun, after which we will begin to hurtle towards something else, the Christmas holiday, the Easter holiday, never any rest. When we arrive, we will find they add velocity to whatever drives us forward. It's September next week, and the summer's already turned its back. Already the weather has stopped being accountable. There will be a few more beautiful afternoons when we can turn outside from the spaces we have made, spaces that have become unbearable. Summer is a platform from which to think about fall. In summer, some men see more of their families than they do all year. Others stay in town with colleagues, with women, who cannot leave town. Sometimes often you do not holiday with us or you leave early work. How have I lived in these times you have left? In abeyance. I thought it would be freedom without you. It is not. The thing that I have with you is pegged to different parts of my body. When I move, when you move, one of them tugs, others slacken it, so I don't feel I am tied in those places, though I am. In 1 month, it will no longer feel like summer, and I do not want to go into the dark again. I go back into the sea because there is nothing else to do. Or there is, but I do not do it. When I reach the harbour, there is a sign. It says, do not bathe. Do not swim the channel, à cause de something, des courants, etc., à cause de bateau. I did not see a sign like this on the other side of the estuary. There is a ferry, but it doesn't go for hours. I have no money, but if I wait, if I tell the boatman my situation, I might persuade him to take me. The light of the lighthouse blinks and the light on the boats, one by one. I look out from under eyelids puffed by salt water. I have seen harbours like this before, in Nice, in Marseille, but none so narrow as this one, so difficult to get into or out of. I walk back to the beach and walk into the sea. It is my choice. Shall I tell you what it is like to drown? It is very calm and quiet. I step over from the blue to the ink-coloured water. I cannot see beneath me. I have never been afraid of the sea. I had not understood people who were. That was because I had only seen its surface and the things that float on it, like boats and seagulls. The surface of the sea is round when viewed at eye level, like the horizon, like the earth. It tips flat as a plate each time I do, both hemispheres reorienting around me, whatever my angle. The two hemispheres are unequal. The lower hemisphere is cold. I do not know what goes on there. It is vast, and in it is 90% of my body, which is kicking. In the hemisphere above, in which things seem more varied, the sky, the land, the buildings, the people on the beach, is my head. Having made myself so very available, I'm virtually concave. Will I sink or swim? Depends which way up you place me. Pretend it's fiction. Pretend you are drowning, or pretend not to be drowning because maybe you are. Though it's difficult to tell, the outcome will be identical. I say you. Of course, I mean me. Far away, a small motorboat turns in my direction, and although it is a very small boat and very far away, I am unable to see anything above the underside of its prow, which prompts the idea that there is no reason anyone on the boat could see my small dark head, which I can hardly get above the level of the waves. Though the boat is small, it is big enough to kill me if it does not see me. I tread water, going neither forward nor back, and then there are a few moments. There is the moment I think I will stop and wave so that the boat steering towards me is less likely to kill me inattentively, but I do not, because I have already thought this will not work and this thought has cost me some energy. Instead, I continue for a moment to tread water, knowing that though this may prevent me from going forward into the path of the boat, I will lose more energy. Then, partly because it is less risky, and partly because I cannot stop myself, I shout in a small voice, "No, no!" The boat turns towards the shore. As my life concerns only the circle of water around me, these moments recede quickly into the past. The boat turns towards the shore and the danger is years away. I was not the same person then, or I'm not now. In front of me is the same struggle for life. The thing to do is to pretend the entirety of under the water is not happening, or is happening to someone else, or that no, that the context in which it is happening is entirely different, or that each movement made cannot be made otherwise, or even better, to put it out of my mind to find it boring. But if I died, the salt meniscus that curves under my bottom lip, if it were to curve over, if it were to become what is inside as well as outside me, and that's all it's a matter of. The thought of drowning used to smell of chlorine. Now it smells of salt. Each death is specific, and the fear during death is nothing like the fear of death at other times. My fear is of this specific death. I can see the people on the beach who are lying with their toes towards the water. They are not very far away, but they are not looking in the right direction to see my head. On my head is my mouth, which is above the waterline and with which I could call to alert someone on the beach to my drowning. But my mouth is connected to my lungs, which, being below the waterline, are cold and so constricted by the weight of water as to make the action of shouting difficult. If I stopped swimming to tread water enough to raise my head, if I inflated my lungs enough to call to them, I would no longer be able to pull against the current, and the shouting would not be loud enough, not in the right language, and do no good. And even if they are good people and attentive, they may not be able to act in time. If I drown, whose fault will it be? The fault of the waves? The lack of a sign? The fear inspired by the sign? Lack of sufficient muscle? Does it matter whose fault it is? But there is not much time to regret other people, their actions or inactions. Isn't drowning enough for one day? Here we are in the present. Me in here and you with the children on the other side, two amongst others. We have got this far and we are not mad. We are not drunks or drug addicts, though perhaps we should be. We do not shout in the street, and when you stand next to us on the bus, we do not smell bad. We are not murderers or rapists or paedophiles. We are adulterers, probably no more than in thought. We do not take things without paying at the self-checkout tills in the supermarkets. Some of us do not even jaywalk. We don't steal milk from other people's doorsteps, even when our own has gone. And if we see a cheap necklace lost in the street, we drape it over a nearby wall or post so it won't get crushed and so that the owner will be able to see it if she comes back that way to look for it. Despite everything, we are good people. You can hardly live in this world that continues almost entirely at our expense. The best thing is to keep on moving arms and legs and to watch the waves, almost as though moving forward. In this way, despair turns quickly over to happiness and back to despair again. And if you reach the beach, walk back across it like everything is fine, towards your family who would not like to see the abyss you have just swum over.